Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Abarca with Andy Lipson, and we have our guest for part three of this interview with Will, former naval officer, socialist, and high school teacher. We will be delving in. What is it, Andy?
You're good. Okay.
His face says a lot sometimes, so I need to just talk about it. What is it, Andy?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, let's do this again.
No, we're fine. Just keep going.
Excuse me. We will be speaking with Will, our guest, socialist, high school teacher, and former naval officer, and we will be delving into his military experience in this part three of the episode. Specifically, we'll be going into his military experience during the Iraq War period of time. And welcome back, Will. Thank you for being with us. I'm really happy you're here once again.
Thank you for having me once again, and thanks to my wife for watching the kids again.
Yeah, I know.
It's a pleasure to talk with you guys.
Yeah.
Thank you, Stacy.
Yes. And kids.
And the children.
Yes. I guess one question I might have just prior to really getting into some of your experiences is you've actually been the person we've interviewed the most, and I'm wondering what this process has been like for you, or what have you thought about, you know, this kind of marathon of two, and now it's going to be the third hour of being interviewed about all these experiences and thoughts and stuff.
Well, it's a great pleasure to speak about, you know, sort of my, not just my life, but kind of my perspective on my life, which obviously a lot of what we've talked about is part of everybody's life, you know, especially in military expeditions. And it's something that I always wanted to talk about more, and so I've never written it down. And this process of talking about it has inspired me to take that step to write all this stuff down, because a lot of it is kind of drifting from my memory now. And there's just a lot of sort of insider stuff that I think makes it a little bit more personal. I mean, it's not like I'm not like a boots on the ground kind of perspective. So I never had to watch anybody die, but it is sort of one story in that narrative of the Iraq War, because a lot of times it's kind of hard to relate to the headlines. You know, the headlines are just so impersonal. But I think that's one sort of aspect that of my life that kind of led to my radicalism, is that the Iraq War was a part of my life, and I feel responsibility for it. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you guys, and you know, also to know what is interesting to other people, because it's hard to know. Like, I think it's all interesting, but I never know like how much of it will be interesting to other people.
Yeah, I've found it fascinating, and I really appreciate this opportunity. And I think we'll probably get right into it. I've actually, in both episodes, episode one and episode two, you've kind of alluded to and actually really wanted to talk about an event which happened on while you were on which ship? Was the first one?
It was when I was on, it was the second one, when I was an officer on Benfold, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to just get into this event you were going to talk about? You sent us some a little clipping about a mission that, well, I don't know whether to describe whether it went wrong or went right, but it was not, to me, it looks like a war crime. Well, maybe you want to talk about a little bit more.
Something?
I was thinking I'm just going to, you know, go with this. Yeah.
Tell us the year, Will.
Yeah, so it was the end of 2009, I think. So I was still fresh on the ship. I'd been there like 6 months or something.
Obama years.
And Obama years, early Obama years, and I had a friend in the who was the strike officer who runs the division that plans that maintains the Tomahawk missiles and plans the missions and everything. And he one day he I made friends with this guy and we talked about all kinds of stuff. We were both pretty cynical early on, and he had been there maybe a little bit before I was, so we kind of had that thing together. We complained together about the Navy, which is sort of a popular pastime of all sailors. One day he showed me a newspaper article. This was, I think, in December. Yeah, it was December 2009. That the newspaper article reported that the Yemeni Air Force had struck, conducted airstrikes against Al Qaeda in Yemen. And he told me this article that he pointed to this article and he said, "This is not true. It was actually a Tomahawk strike." He said, "I know because we planned it." And it was and it this just kind of blew me away. I like I said, I'd already become cynical, but it was like I don't know, just to be so directly involved, I guess, and sort of like this covert operation that we were basically lying again to the American people about what we were doing. Anyways, this attack, it got the article in front of me. It killed 14 alleged Al Qaeda. How much I believe that is not much at all, but 41 civilians, including 14 women and 21 children. Well, it came out,
And the article also
I think about
says
6 months.
where the attack hit as well. Can you say where the attack actually hit
And the source?
Yeah, it was, I don't know how to say it, but it was the Al-Majala camp attack. It's also known as the Al-Majala massacre. This is in Yemen. So, yeah, it's in southern Yemen near the coast. So it came out several months later. Amnesty International released photos showing an American cluster bomb and propulsion unit from a Tomahawk missile. And what I learned was that our ship had conducted the planning for this strike, and either because we weren't in the right location or maybe we had a technical issue. Anyway, we ended up giving the plans to a different ship. I'm not sure which ship it was. It might have been Donald Cook, or but they actually launched the attack. And I think I just kind of put this in my back pocket at the time. I didn't think too much about it because we were just so busy, and I didn't know what to make of it. But it came out later that it was a Tomahawk strike, and basically everybody had lied about it. And I think the story was actually broke by Jeremy Scahill, who is an investigative reporter, excellent investigative reporter, who now reports for The Intercept. He did a lot of work before that with Democracy Now. But if you watch the documentary called Dirty Wars, they talk about this strike. So yeah, basically found out firsthand that before it was a story that we conducted basically a covert operation, which that's supposed to be part of like Joint Special Operations Command, not like regular ships like us. So it just felt like, the Navy running amok, basically. What if we can go ahead and do covert operations and lie about it? Like, where is the line? It just felt like there is no line. Like, we lie about everything. And of course, I didn't know at the time that that's actually true. I didn't know about the truth about the corporate media and all that, but really, there is no distinctive line between covert operations and conventional operations. The myth that Congress has to declare war, of course, is absolutely false. That we have a democracy where the people have to decide to go to war. It's not reality. But so yeah, that's pretty much. But 23 children.
Yeah,
And supposedly,
no, sorry, go ahead.
the primary target, Qasim al-Raimi, and he survived the attack. So, obviously, wasn't worth it. Not even close.
Can you mention the article from where you read that? Your friend showed you the article.
Yeah, I think it was think it was a New York Times article that where he the one that he showed me. It was one of Yeah, I'm not sure which one it was.
It's
It was
okay. I think
probably
what
reported
I'm trying to
in
get
all the
at
main.
is that how many of our how many people really trust sources like the New York Times, and we think of them as people trying to inform us, And this was in the New York Times, one of the most it's a leading newspaper here in the USA. So and this is almost in alliance with the military and government conspir well co covert operations that they tried to do to how do you say engañarnos? Engañar is to deceive us.
Right. Yeah, I think it reported that Obama, like, that it was a US supported attack, but they said that the Yemeni Air Force actually conducted it, but it was actually US forces.
And the US would have known that because, like you said, they had literally planned the operation on your ship, even though the Tomahawk missiles came from another ship. And so the target that was decided on, the day it was decided on, when it would happen, all known in advance by the United States. And then when this goes down and a bunch of children are killed, a bunch of civilians are killed, the first thing they do is they report that it was the Yemeni army. And has the US ever then gone back and said, "Oh yeah, it was us," or have they continued to deny it?
Well, it was reported eventually that they did. I think they probably acknowledged it. But I don't. It was probably a very, very subtle acknowledgement, as low level as possible. Probably, not like front page news kind of thing, but like a tacit acknowledgement. But they're very good at sort of sweeping everything under the rug, so.
And as you said in your interview, I think the first one, your radicalization really did come within the military. Did how much was hearing this about this? I guess I have two questions. One, what effect did it have on like your colleague, and maybe did other people on the ship know about this? Was it kind of people wouldn't talk about it? That's number one. And number two, how much of a role did hearing things like this play in you starting to become disgusted with the, US empire, with capitalism, things like that?
I was becoming disgusted with everything pretty quickly. I guess what were the problems right in front of me were more like internal, like just seeing the problems on the ship and the problems with the military chain of command, just the sort of that my boss at the time was just awful. The people below me were kind of acting like tyrants. And I was just kind of like, just I felt compelled to just go with the flow because I mean, what I was surrounded by this culture, this authoritarian culture of, cover your ass, get promoted, hold the people below you accountable for whatever they've been ordered to do, so I guess that was just more on my radar, and this foreign policy stuff was like more in the background. But I mean, obviously, it was in the back of my mind. I didn't know how to make sense of it. I remember being angry pretty quickly. Let me back up a little bit, because I don't think I mentioned that my brother was a socialist. And back at start, he had joined the Navy, enlisted in when I think he enlisted a few years after me, 2004, and was in for 4 years from 2004 to 2008. And after he left, he went to college, and he didn't stay in like I did. He went to college and ended up becoming like a student activist at UCLA, and he was a socialist, and he was, he went to VNet, which is or VMI, which is like the socialist summer camp for VNet. And so I was kind of hearing stuff from him, and he went to my graduation because I was all excited about Obama, and he told me like, he was like, nothing's gonna change, right? And I was like, what? What do you mean nothing's gonna change? Like, how can you say that? Like, how do you know nothing's gonna change? Like, and he told me all kinds of crazy stuff. Like, he was telling me about, I think the thing that kind of blew my mind was that he was telling me about, like, he got me thinking about political economy, and especially the political economy of the media. So he's telling me, asking me like, how do you think New York Times makes its money? Well, I don't know. It's, circulation, like people paying for subscriptions. No, they make it primarily through advertising. Who do you think is buying ads in the New York Times? I don't know, like businesses? Like, yeah, big businesses. So who is funding the New York Times? Oh, it's big business. Okay, so what kind of perspectives do you think they're going to be pushing? Like, I don't know, like, I don't know. What does that mean? And he's like, well, what kind of interests do big businesses have? And he's like, I don't know. He's like, this is my little brother, by the way. He's 3 years younger than me. And
See,
he's like,
he's taking you to school.
and he's like, what they want to keep costs down, right? They want to minimize their production costs, maximize profits. So wage costs, they want to keep wages low. They want to keep environmental regulations low. They want to keep labor regulations low, or at a minimum. And it was like stuff that I'd never ever thought about before. It's like these are the interests of the New York Times and all the corporate media. And I mean, I didn't really like, honestly, it sounded crazy to me at the time. But of course, like I'm thinking about this because he got the wheels turning, so, for years I just kind of like had it in the back of my mind. And so I don't know how much I thought about what he was saying at the time, but I was kind of like, I was watching to see if what he said was true about Obama. Are things going to change or not? And I noticed like, I think the big thing for me and Stacy at the time was like, he said he was going to close Gitmo. And I felt pretty strongly about that. And of course, he never closed it.
I mean,
And it was like,
Guantanamo
time
Bay
goes
at that
on. It's like,
point, there
when
was
are we going to
no
close
peace,
this?
sorry for interrupting.
Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, detention facility,
Thank you.
where they're basically torturing people suspected of being terrorists, which basically means any Arab. So I'm like, this is just another data point for me. It's like, that my brother's right. Nothing's changing. Everything's the same. It's not, it wasn't Bush. It's Obama too. It's like, it's not even the president. It's the whole system. And I didn't understand it. And honestly, like part of me was still thinking, oh, this is crazy. Because, that's just a huge claim to make, like just to turn your world upside down. It doesn't just happen overnight. And, but I didn't have time to investigate any of this stuff. I was just trying to keep my head above water and not get fired. And so I wasn't reading anything. The only thing I was, I'd come home from work and me and Stacy would like watch documentaries and stuff. But it was normally about like, food health. But some of the documentaries we watched were like about Wall Street. Someone were like, we watched one called The End of Poverty, which talked about like the way that the IMF and the World Bank give loans to third world countries is a form of extortion to get them to basically deregulate and sell off, public infrastructure. And so it's like we're educating ourselves about all kinds of stuff on Netflix, and but yeah, so just rapidly becoming disgusted with the Navy internally, but still trying to do a good job, just for my own sake, just to maintain the sense of personal integrity, I guess. I wasn't ready to give up the definition of honor that I'd carried around, which was basically doing a good job at whatever it is you're doing, a good job at performing your station, So that was I saw my role as just kind of staying in my lane and doing a good job and leaving politics to the politicians. And yeah, so but I was intrigued at the time by the idea of socialism. I didn't know anything about it, but the way I kind of expressed it was I would tell my captain, my brother's a socialist, like, and kind of watch his reaction. And it was like sitting around at the in the wardroom, which is like the officers' dining table. We dine in a special area. It's like, unlike the Marines who basically eat with their own, with the rest of them, the Navy officers have like this really class stratified structure where like we eat special food. Like they say it's the same food, but a lot of times it's, we get more of it and we get the better stuff. But anyway, sitting around the dinner table and talking about, just saying my brother's a socialist and watching people's reactions. And I went vegan. Me and my wife went vegan because it seemed like, sort of doing our part, I guess, and sort of like, global warming and animal cruelty type stuff, and also the health of it. And so people. I sort of became like the resident communist. People called me that, even though I didn't know anything about communism or socialism, but I was sort of moving left. And
Was
but that
this
when I was on Benfold, I didn't really. No, go ahead.
during, after, or before what years, more or less? I'm sorry, I'm just trying to get your timeline.
This was. When I was on Benfold, that was 2009 to the end of, it was mid 2009 to the end of 2011. So, yeah, and then 2011, and this goes to show the power of social movements, popular social movements, because 2011 was it September or that's when Occupy kicked off, and I think that was a catalyst for me to, because my brother. he was living in San Diego too at the time, and he was really involved with Occupy at UCLA. And I was really intrigued by this because it was suddenly not an academic thing. Like, this was something that everybody was like getting involved with, and it was like everything was all the things that people were getting pissed off about. It wasn't just inequality. It was the foreign policy. It was all kinds of stuff. And I think that was a catalyst for me to start getting deeper into the research. And my mom sent me a copy of Manufacturing Consent, and I ended up buying the People's History of the United States. Read those when I was, basically in transition from Ben Folds to the next ship, and like I said, just turned my world upside down, kind of completed the sort of process that had been in motion for several years, but I'd
Manufacturing
never
Consent
really
by Noam
committed
Chomsky.
to. What's that?
Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky. You're talking about the book, right? I'm sorry.
Oh,
I just for
no,
our viewers and listeners.
actually, yeah, actually the one that I read first was Understanding Power, which is it's like a collection of talks and interviews that he's given over the years, like including in the 80s. So it was very wide ranging, and it went from everything from he talked about manufacturing consent too, but it was like basically how the world works.
So, well, it sounds like this process that got started in many ways, your brother played a pivotal role in it with these questions that he was asking you. And I guess I'm curious, not just for you in terms of I kind of want to go back to the event that happened with the Tomahawk missile attack on on the village in Yemen. Because Eduardo pointed this out. I mean, that did happen in 2009. That's Obama years, where there's, a civilian massacre by the United States, which is planned by the United States and lied about by the United States under Barack Obama, which I think is part of the reason why people have been so many people were so disgusted. It's part of the reason that Occupy, I think, got kicked off, was because people expected a change and they didn't get it. But I'm wondering, how are these the sorts? Are you unique within the military to hear about these sorts of things, or do most people at some point in time within the military, soldiers or seamen, do they know these sorts of things go on, or they hear about it but they're not able? How do you understand how people in the military respond to these events? Is it that they're ignorant of them, they do know about them but they compartmentalize them, or they don't have a socialist brother to kind of give them a kickstart? And that's kind of my question.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. I think I wonder that if I didn't have, a brother who was a socialist, and I don't know what led him down that path, but I wonder if I would have become a leftist. I honestly think I would have, because my wife and I were kind of coming at it from a different angle. I think anyway, with I guess with more like public health, consumer health issues, like learning about regulatory capture. So I might have come to it from that angle, but I don't know. My mom too, I don't know if my brother, kind of led my mom or the other way around, but it was like we were all kind of moving in that direction. But my mom was watching Democracy Now, when I was in the Naval Academy, and was, trying to get me to watch it, but I ne never got interested in it. Not that Democracy Now! Is really r super radical, but it definitely, it's eye-opening a lot of times.
I guess another question that I have is, based on this, your experience, based on, what you just saw happened here, and the the complete lie about the U.S. military and its missions, its willingness to do all sorts of illegality. I mean, I would say the war itself was illegal anyway, but whatever. What do you think are the prospects for more people in the military coming to that understanding, starting to rebel essentially against the process? What are your thoughts on that process, given your own experience and what you saw of your comrades around you? Do you have thoughts on how that's gonna, if it can't, if it could go down, because it's gonna have to if we're gonna have a revolution? And what do you think are the conditions that would make it possible for a broader radicalization to take place within the military, where it essentially sides with the resistance here at home? I don't mean the resistance like Trump. I mean resistance to capitalism, resistance to the system.
Well, I think the key is you want to go for the lower ranks because they're just going to be a lot easier to sway. And I think there's definitely, there's a lot of potential there. The problem is it's high risk. So, obviously a public-facing kind of like a radical grouping in the military is even more risky than one in the workplace, which is really risky. The difference is you'll get fired and if it's in the workplace, whereas you'll get sent to prison if it's in the military. Well, actually, depends, I guess. As long as you're sort of not advocating violent overthrow in the military, you might just get away with a administrative separation or something. They probably want to keep it under the wraps, but I mean, I guess that West Point grad and army officer who was openly communist, kind of shows, how much you can get away with. What's his name? Can't remember his name.
Neither, I think you mentioned him last episode, and
Yeah,
I don't
but
remember his name, but I remember he had, like, his graduating, he had on his hat, graduating hat, like, something about being a communist or something like that.
yeah. And I think he was prior enlisted too. So, I think prior enlisted guys are just a little bit more aware. But yeah, I would say, doing it from the inside is going to be difficult. But things like I would guess that nowadays it's a lot more common to find people with radical ideas in the military. You have things like the Black Lives Matter movement, which I imagine, has a lot of sympathy within the black sailors and soldiers, obviously. At least some of them. I remember talking with a couple of people. They're largely in agreement with me about a lot of things. And I guess the key is like how do you kind of cohere that? I mean, I guess it would have to be like a below ground kind of network, which honestly it wouldn't be that hard to do. Anyways, I mean, yeah, it should be done. I guess that's the important part is we need to try to establish connections with people on the inside of every industry. And because I think the way, I'm an example of the power of social relationships. I think, propaganda can only take you so far. But ideology is much more. I think one analogy is like ideology is a fish that swims, in social relationships. If you don't have those relationships, it's like a fish out of water. It's not gonna survive. And that's why people talk about unions as sort of like a mechanical power, power at the point of production to sort of disrupt the flow of capital. But I think of it a little bit differently. I think of it as a network of social relationships where ideology can be transmitted, through word and practice. So I think the key is, making relationships, talking to people, and making these, our leftist organizations very, very easy to access in confidence. So if a sailor wanted to get in touch with us, on the down low, we would be able to do that. And that requires a high degree of trust too. So lots of considerations, but I guess the important thing is it should be done. We need to, get out there and start building those relationships and get off the electoral politics, focus. I mean, like Noam Chomsky says, that deserves about 10 minutes of our time, forget about the rest. But it's like I look at my news feed and everybody's, even anarchists, they're, posting stuff about political candidates, more than they're posting anything. Like, we should be talking about strategy and tactics, like, but instead, like, everybody is just, even radicals are fixated on this upcoming election, which is a year from now.
So in line with that, this is something we've talked about on this web, on this podcast or channel, is about our project and trying to do it in the teachers union. And of course, we imagine that there's hopefully somebody within the auto workers, people trying to do that same sort of thing. And we are a long way away from that within the working class within the United States. And I will tell you that process. But I think it's possible, but we have a lot to overcome. Some people think that that's impossible to happen within the U.S. military. What's your assessment of that? Like, in the same way that, yes, it's actually a very tall task for those of us within the working class in the United States to take that big step. What are your feelings about the possibility of really doing that within the U.S. military?
I think it's definitely possible. I think for me, the key is kind of like we have to develop a credible movement. I mean, we have to develop a credible theoretical alternative that doesn't sound like, live action role play. Because, a lot of the left, I feel like, is just the reason. It's easy to blame our failures on capitalist repression, but when I look at the left, I see a tendency to struggle for struggle's sake. So, like, this formula of class struggle produces social change. I think we need to give something. I think we need to give people more to struggle for. We need people to have a future worth fighting for. So that's kind of like what Bernie Sanders' movement is about. And that's why he has so much popularity, I guess. It just seems more possible. But you look at the far left, that it's more like social movement oriented. And I see this sort of struggle for struggle's sake mentality. And I wish, like, I harp a lot on just the development of what is socialism? What is it that we want? And, kind of charting a path to get there. And not like, I mean, with humility, like, not like we have all the answers and just follow us to freedom, but offering this sort of like coherent vision and plan, and kind of building a movement around it. So, like, there's a lot of important debates that aren't being had. So I guess I think that needs to happen. And anyway, so regarding the military, I think basically we need more of a credible socialist movement. And I guess I have kind of a build it and they will come mentality, where we can't go to the people with what we have right now because it's kind of half-baked and ossified and outdated. Like, for example, one of the most credible organizations on the left, is the IWW, which, its ideology hasn't changed. The theory of change hasn't changed since 1905, basically. And I mean, we really just have to I think a lot of that is the left doesn't even believe in its own vision. So I think we have to believe in ourselves, and we have to believe in the ideas, and we have to think that it's possible. And we really have to work it out. And we have to challenge ourselves. Like, when people, we have to be willing to answer those tough questions and be willing to say, I don't know, when we don't know, and try to figure it out. So, but I guess I feel like if we had a more credible movement with a kind of a more developed vision, then it would be a lot easier to answer those kinds of questions about the military, because it'd be like, here's this. When there's a bright shining mountain on the horizon, it's visible from every vantage in society, and it's not like we have that right now. But if we did have that, I think sailors and soldiers would take note, and they would be coming to us. But the experience of new recruits in the left is kind of the opposite. It's kind of alienating, and we kind of repel people rather than draw them in. I guess the bigger problem for me is just the left, and I think that's related to this kind of distinction we have between the left and labor, for example. There shouldn't be a distinction. The left should be labor. The labor movement is the socialist movement. That's how I see it. The movement for workers' self-management. I see it as synonymous with the labor movement and the socialist movement. So I think that, understanding things like that will take us a long way. But all this stuff is philosophical, it's theoretical, and it's, for some people it's boring, and some people just want to, hit the streets, like some people just want to fight. And I understand that, and I respect that, but that's not going to be enough.
It's been my suspicion that there's a debate within the ruling class on concerns about numbers of tours of duty, the degree to which the U.S. is getting exhausted in Afghanistan and Iraq and in the Middle East. In my opinion, that is the basis for where folks like Trump and Pompeo are starting to talk about pulling troops out of there so they can tilt towards China. What is your own assessment of, because there have been, like in Vietnam, the level of exhaustion for the U.S. military was after 2 to 3 or 4 tours. Now we're talking about soldiers who've gone 5 tours, 6 tours. What is your sense of what's happening within the U.S. military around that, in terms of its war-making ability, at the level of the soldier and the seaman?
Well, that's hard to address. I would say that in Vietnam, that there was a real crisis of the ability to continue making war, because you had the draft, so you had people from all walks of life joining the military, and they were a lot more radicals. Whereas now you have an all volunteer force. And so self-selecting, kind of more of a self-selecting military. And so that makes it a little bit more ideologically sustainable for the military, because people are actually, even if you're not like politically conservative, the fact that you signed up just gives you a little bit more of a sense of obligation, I guess. Whereas if you're conscripted, it's like, you're forced into it. You don't have a sense of ownership. So I think the patriotism now is a bigger problem in the military than it used to be. But I do think that, PTSD is a big problem. I mean, I guess the other thing is it's so technologically heavy now, as opposed to, personnel heavy. So we do just a lot more nowadays with a lot fewer people. You know, how many people are involved in a drone strike versus an actual bombing run? And then, you know, you got precision bombing as opposed to these, very public relations costly sort of carpet bombing that they did in Vietnam. So it's a lot more special ops heavy. So it's just a lot easier for the United States to conduct these wars around the globe, these sort of covert wars, low-level conflicts, than I think it used to be. I mean, they really grew special operations by a lot. So, you know, honestly, I don't know that I've seen many hard limits for U.S. imperialism, you know, as far as the personnel goes. Yeah. Although, I mean, I will say that the fact that they do have to do things covertly is a testament to, you know, the spirit of the 60s. It is harder for a president to go to full out war on any country just because it's not as popular as it used to be. So I think that's one victory we can claim, is that people are just not as interested in that sort of thing. People are not as supportive of the government. I mean, public trust in the government has just been on the decline for, you know, since World War II. And I think that's a huge part of the decline of the U.S. empire overall, is just the lack of the loss of prestige over the years from these foreign invasions.
Well, my own sense is actually the US military and the US empire has actually reclaimed a lot of essentially credibility in the question of bringing democracy, and racism and anti-Muslim sentiment has been a big part of doing that, resuscitating the notion that these people who are being bombed are fanatics, are jihadists, the use of the term ISIS to describe anyone, and the anti-war movement falls for it, in my opinion. I'm just stating my opinion. I guess what I'm going to ask about is something that is not really talked about too much on the left and among socialists, but I want to get your thoughts on it. And I sent you a question about this because my sense is historically, when militaries have been radicalized, it's generally by them being defeated on the ground, whether that was in the U.S. and Vietnam, whether it was the French military finding its losses in Port in no, it's Portu the Portuguese army finding its losses in Africa, and the French army in Africa as well. And I do think that the U.S. losing a military, losing a war, is related to the process of radicalization, both within the U.S. military and at home. And socialists have had a position, particularly in the Russian Revolution, of what's called revolutionary defeatism, that is, calling for the defeat of their own army in an imperial war, where the Russian Bolsheviks were accused of being traitors because they were like, you want Germany to win this war against Russia. And they were like, we want Russia to lose because Russia is in part of an imperial project. And that has been an unpopular position for socialists and revolutionaries to take, that is, calling for the defeat of the U.S. empire in Afghanistan or Iraq or in Syria. But I believe that that's the right position for revolutionaries to take, is we want our military to lose because, one, it's good for those countries, it's good for the globe, and it's part of taking down our own government, part of bringing our military to our side ultimately. I'm wondering what you think of that.
I guess it depends. Like I can definitely, you know, when I think of like the German military sort of refusing to go on missions, which I think kind of sparked the German Revolution of 1918. Yeah, I think it began with sailors basically, you know, refusing to go on the next mission because it was like a suicide mission, I think. And so I think that's, you know, there's different, I guess it really depends on the situation. I guess I could see how it could be politically costly to sort of call for just defeat of the U.S. military, because then it just it you know we have to be careful of the image of like wanting another country to win, basically like siding with Russia or siding with, because we don't want to be siding with another state. I think that's one big mistake the left, often makes, is like a lot of people side with Assad or side with, I don't know. It's possible to be against the United States imperialism and also acknowledge the crimes of other states. I mean, so I don't know. I guess my answer is I guess it just depends. But I do think that we don't definitely don't want to be siding with our own government, as in war. I mean, that's never a good position to take.
I wanted to, if it's all right, sort
Yes.
of transition into something. Recently, we've had Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, we've had, Julian Assange. We've had whistleblowers, and let's not forget from the what's her name right now? Her name escapes me. She was she shared information.
Oh, yeah. Something freedom.
Oh, yeah.
What her name is?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Recently, we have been on this show talking about whistleblowers, and the reason why I'm mentioning it is because right now in the news and the headlines, we're hearing impeachment inquiries or now impeachment proceed the process of an impeachment, and there is this talk about whistleblower, but this whistleblower specifically is being protected under the law. And supposedly a legal and more legitimate whistleblower. Although I have my doubts of this whistleblower, simply as I have our viewers and listeners can look at our episode on this, because other whistleblowers are not being protected, but this whistleblower seems to be protected, and I seem to think it's because it's in favor of the Democrats right now. Whereas we've had other whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning that has been, what do you call it when Obama. What do you call pardoned? And then you have Chelsea Manning going back now into prison. No? So what kind of pardon is that, right? It doesn't benefit the government. You have them pardoned and then you go back in. The point I'm trying to make, Will, here is that there are people who really truly do feel this, what I would say is true patriotism, if it exists. I'm not a very patriotic person, but who really do have a love for the public and the people they serve, and especially in the military, or even if it's not on the grounds, on the boots, they are trying to give the public notice. Our government is in cahoots. Our government is committing murder. How do you see it from your perspective here, given the experience you've had in the military? How do you see all of this in the news? How do you see whistleblowers, given the lens that you have?
And to add one thing to that, particularly the criticism of Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange, is that they're, and Edward Snowden, is that they're threatening national security, they're threatening actual missions, they're threatening people's lives by what they do. What do you make of that?
Yeah, the idea that they're threatening people's lives just doesn't hold any water whatsoever. And even the U.S. government, I think, dropped those claims because they couldn't substantiate them. There was really no evidence that Chelsea Manning's disclosures, risk anybody's life. And most state secrets, they're not about anybody's safety. They're just about keeping things secret from the American people. Because otherwise they wouldn't get away with it. And I remember when Chelsea Manning's leaks came out, it was I was on Benfold, and it was a big deal because we had to really change our information security policies, and
More
it changed a
controls.
lot as far as how we well, you know, because I was like in charge of the network at the time, so they what was it? I think we weren't allowed to. They weren't letting people use thumb drives. They really clamped down like hugely. It had to be like a CD. You had to use like CD-ROMs or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they ended up having to loosen up because it was such a huge clampdown that it made doing anything very difficult. But I think I see those people as heroes. Especially Chelsea Manning, because she, I mean, she took a huge risk, and people want to sort of point to, psychologize her and make it sound like she had issues, and that's why she did it. And I don't think that there is anything to that. I think she just did it because it was the right thing to do, and which that takes a lot of, it takes a lot of personal integrity. And, I don't think I could have done that. Personally, I don't think I would have done that. So I think she's a hero. And Julian Assange, the same. I don't know too much about him. I know people are kind of mixed on Julian Assange because, maybe he was like aiding Trump or something. I mean, I think Assange, may have been misguided at times, but overall, I think he was well-intentioned, and he was damaging the credibility of the U.S. government. And that, anytime that happens, I think it's a good thing. And I wish, I know he also allegedly sexually assaulted a couple of women in another country. And, I gather that has a high chance of being true, and it would be better if he sort of owned up to it. But, you never know for sure, but chances are it's true. So that kind of damages his image. But I guess what matters as far as, not whether they're heroes or not heroes, but like how are they treated? And it's very clear that they're being persecuted because of their disclosures, and they're trying to make an example out of them. They don't want this to happen again, so they're punishing them as much as they possibly can to deter future whistleblowers from coming forward.
I wanted to just mention Reality Lay Winner. She is the former U.S. American intelligence specialist. She is the one in 2017 who was charged with removing classified material from a government facility and mailing it to a news outlet, which is allegedly The Intercept. And it was material in question originally from the NSA, National Security Agency. So I guess then, from your perspective, then, are you then saying then that it is very, very difficult to release sensitive, classified information in the military? And after these whistleblowers came out, then especially Reality Winner and
Chelsea Manning.
Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, the government claps down, you're saying, from you from your personal experience, you're saying that was your experience in the military, that it just tightened security more, making it harder for people to release information. And can you add to that, how are people penalized? Did you all get talked to about how, if anything, could be repercussions on you all as people who serve for the military?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I think we always had kind of like information security trainings, but you know how like I'm sure you guys do these like web-based computer-based trainings where you have to do them once a year about all kinds of stuff. And one of the ones that we have to do is, I can't remember what it's called, but there are a bunch of them. One is like information security. And some of these trainings, they go through the list of whistleblowers and they completely villainize Assange and Chelsea Manning. Basically putting them alongside people who are in the pay of the Russian KBG, KGB. So they're painting these people as basically aides to the enemy rather than people who are disclosing something that they think the American people should know, which I think is an important distinction because, was it John Walker? I can't remember the name of the. There have been people in the military who they wanted money and they got money from the KGB to get classified information, and so they were arrested under the, I think the Espionage Act for that, and that's different from Chelsea Manning or Julian Assange because they're disclosing things. For different reasons, not for selfish reasons, but for all of humanity. Anyways, yeah. So these trainings, I guess that would be like sort of part of the clampdown to kind of like discourage you from. And part of it too is like they also really encourage you to not trust your shipmates, your fellow sailors, and that this sort of see something, say something mentality is just kind of creepy. It's sort of like imagine like a fascist society. It's kind of like what the military culture is really. Militarized society, I guess.
One last question, and this is sort of on this. Today's politics are really been centered around impeachment and Ukraine and Russia. Have you any thoughts on the stuff that's going on here with between the Republican Party, Democratic Party, Russia Gate, Ukraine Gate? What are your thoughts on all this?
That's ridiculous. I don't follow it at all. It's ridiculous. Yeah, I don't have much to say about it. I think it's just a stupid distraction. The whole thing is completely disingenuous. The things that they're trying to catch, that they've always been trying to catch Trump on, is it's nothing new. It's this stuff is nothing that Democratic predecessors haven't done. I mean, I'm guessing. I mean, I don't know the details of the accusations, but it's all completely cynical. It's disingenuous. I have no respect for these liberal resistance crusaders who are, posing as if they're fighting the forces of evil. I don't pay any attention to it.
So you have this has been such a great interview. I have a question. I wanted to ask about the brother. And I
Yes.
yeah,
Okay.
go ahead. I hope it's
Is your brother still a socialist? And how has your relationship changed since you've become more radical?
I don't. We don't talk as much as we used to when we were kids. We grew up like best friends together, and he lives out in Oregon. We haven't talked too much, but every now and then I talk to him about people like Bertrand Russell, and I think he's less involved with the left now. I think he was. Well, I don't want to speak for him, but. People get involved with the left and they kind of like witness the leftist subculture and the activist sort of drama that happens. And sometimes people get burned out and they lose confidence in themselves or in the left and they kind of drift away from the movement. I don't know that that's what happened with him, but may have been.
Yeah, it's a common story.
Yeah, it's all too common. A fun what's happened with me.
Wait, say it again.
I said it almost happened with me, but I'm too OCD. I obsess over things, so.
Yeah, you probably, in order to stay a revolutionary today, you have to have some sort of psychological problem, you know. There's really, it kind of drives you a little crazy. And that's, I actually think that that's one of the problems you're getting to is the left has to be a place that is healthier, for people to survive in.
Yeah, and a huge part of that is just being able to like talk things through and a more pluralistic kind of culture, like being able to take a position without doing it in like a condescending way, I guess.
What do you make of the elections, Will, given your perspective, your lens and your military experience and just everything that we've talked about?
Elections, well, I don't follow the elections too closely. My thing is like whoever wins the primary, I'm gonna vote for the lesser evil. It's pretty simple, you know, like the electoral problem. Otherwise, it's just kind of a dog and pony show. Like we don't really have any control over it. We can, you know, listen to the commentary all we want, but I mean, in the end, it comes down to one or two choices. So, I guess Sanders is probably the better candidate. Although I think a lot of times people make a lot more of the differences between Warren and Sanders, and they probably are, but I do think Sanders is probably the better one. So I guess I hope he wins the primary. I think that'll be good at the very least because, you know, people might be sort of disabused of this notion that that change happens by elections. If he does win and nothing changes, then maybe people will kind of see the light. But I think he's going to end up, if he does win, I think he's going to end up breaking a lot of promises. I don't know which ones, but I don't see all the stuff that he's saying he's going to do. I don't see it happening. And, you know, just the experience of Obama saying he's going to do all these things and then not actually being able to do them for whatever reason. I mean, not behind the scenes, so I can't say why, but wasn't able to do it. So I just don't think a lot of that stuff is actually going to happen unless we develop the power to make it happen. And we don't have the power. You know, we're kind of like people are awakening to the power of the strike, with the GM strike and the teacher strike movement. But I think we're also coming up against the limits of these sort of neutral unions, these politically neutral unions. And we're going to have to, we need more, we need a radical, like a socialist labor movement, if that makes, so we need socialists in labor, organized as socialists, you know, not trying to battle, not trying to battle the reformers for control over the neutral unions, but actually our own element sort of as a catalyst for revolution. Obviously easier said than done, but anyways, your question about the elections, I guess, you know, that's what needs to happen.
Thank you, Will. I think this concludes our episode. It is already 11:29, and I'm making sure that we are on time, as always. I really do appreciate.
It's a pleasure as always to speak with you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Will.
Thank you. I really do appreciate this symposium, I guess, or the, you know, this entire three. Parts to this interview of you, and it has been a pleasure really listening to you and your perspective and what you bring to the table and your political journey through it, your evolution through it, and And I've been telling Andy as we leave and go to the vehicle after this, every time we close this laptop and we have said goodbye, is that I just am in awe about your evolution, your political journey, and how you've transformed yourself. And there may be differences amongst the three of us, right? And each one of us have our own story. But here on What's Left, we've shared our story already. And just having other people on this episode, on this show, on this podcast, has it's sort of we're trying to have different voices on the left, I think, to try to share about their experience, how they come to it. Some of them tend to vote Democrats, like some of our teachers that we've interviewed. Some of them happen to be anarchists. Others tend to have, this one is unique, I would say, your military background and your socialist evolution. I think that one is unique to our show. And I know these tend to be long, and maybe at the beginning of this one first 2 years phase of our podcast show, maybe it's not going to be as widely as like maybe 3,000 listeners or viewers right now. But as we're building momentum with our podcast, we certainly have at least averagely, I think, 300 listeners on Apple iTunes, and we're not even counting Google Play, Stitcher, and YouTube and stuff like that. People really do listen in, and I really do think that
Wow.
these have some value. And there are pieces in here where you talk, where I know there might be something of a fragmented, no fragment, excuse me, there might be some fragment piece that might make a pivotal change in what they're listening to. And that's why I think we're really committed to hearing people's stories. Almost like, I don't know, like those archive historical stories of the past. And I think this will be one of those in the future, a digital archive where people can look back, what, 200 years from now, 300, even 30, 100, or 50 years from now. I'm going way too far. Anyhow, I appreciate it, Will. And I really do thank Stacy and your kids for this commitment as well. And I'm hoping we'll have you in the future again.
Thank you guys as always, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and definitely hope to stay in touch and keep talking, offline.
We will. Yeah. Did you want to
And
say
maybe I'll
something?
have you guys on my podcast.
I'd love that.
Yes.
And we've been offline, you and I, Will, so we can, I mean, particularly as you go into the teaching thing and things like that, we can certainly talk more. And like Eduardo said, if there's another time you want, when you were like, hey, I want to talk about this, you just let us know and we'll do that. It can be something where it's not even an interview of you, but maybe it's something where
Commentary
it's an issue
about an
where
issue.
the three of us will talk and agree and disagree. Which I think is that is where the left needs to start to rebuild itself, is in the area of being able to continue to work together as they disagree. That is one of the platforms we're going to have to establish for going to the next level. We'd love you to be a part of that.
We especially stress disagreeing with us. Why? Because again, we go back to this thing, what we have always said, when we started this, is that there aren't enough conversations that are challenging on the left as there are on the right. And when Andy said that, I really took that to heart and I was thinking about that. And yes, we need to have more so-called debates, I suppose, disagreements, discussions. He and I have really gone into it, but really to be able to have that on the left to show that we have different voices and we can still be in solidarity and still be disagreement and sift through that, right? How to get through that.
I do want to add, when I first became radicalized, I was, kind of an angry, polemical type of personality, and I learned over time, that's not constructive. So I've been working to take a more, humble and provisional kind of posture, and be open to and respectful of everyone's position. Yeah, I think there's, just what you were saying, we've got to be able to have more conversations, deeper conversations than the left.
Yes, thank you. We will, and I'm sure we'll invite you on sometime. All right, let's conclude then. Please check us out for our new viewers and listeners. Check us out on any of our five platforms on Stitcher, BitChute, Google Play, iTunes Podcast, or YouTube. Please subscribe, rate, review. And best of all, share with your family and community. Thank you for listening, or thank you for watching. Thank you, Will, for being here.
Thanks.
And this concludes our episode.
Thank you, guys.
All right. See you later.
Ciao.